Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The promise of jobs and tax revenue were high in the minds of the governor and the Ohio General Assembly when they were working on new Ohio oil and gas legislation to welcome in the prospects of fracking. That's the process by which shale is, by the process by which they mine shale for oil and gas. Today, we'll consider whether the promises have come to fruition and talk about more proposed regulations intended to shore up some apparent loose ends in the minds of some. Joining us now is Tom Stewart. He's Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Oh, great to be here, Ann. Thank you.
Also joining us is Trent Doherty. He's Director of Legal Affairs for the Ohio Environmental Council. Welcome to the show, Trent.
Thanks, Ann. It's a pleasure.
Tom, Bloomberg News reported last spring, and it was a very dire and dour report, that the $500 billion dream has faded as the Utica Shale has failed to produce as promised. The reporters wrote that the drillers are packing up and leaving. So do you want to debunk that? Is there some truth to that, or is there something to be concerned about?
And oil and gas is a rational process that you don't know what will happen until you drill a hole in the ground and evaluate. We call it testing. Evaluate formations, evaluate geology, match that up against decline curves, how this industry works, and then figure out the economics. When Bloomberg came out with their article, they did it with really very few wells being drilled. That article was almost totally inaccurate on every count. They tried to compare the current results that were coming out that were just announced by the DNR at the time on production for 2012, and then match that up against a talk that the state's geologist gave nearly a year and a half earlier, in which he made a quantitative estimate of what it could produce. He didn't talk about proven reserves, which is a technical term that in which you do a scientific and economic evaluation on what you think your wells will produce. He simply talked about what it, in a quantitative way, what the Utica Shale could produce if fully developed. It was comparing apples to oranges. It was totally inaccurate, and it led to a lot of confusion out there in the press. And quite frankly, you would think an organization such as Bloomberg would be able to get something like that right, but they didn't.
When it comes to the projections from a couple years ago, those are the kinds of numbers that typical, you know, just average everyday Ohioans are paying attention to to figure out whether this is good public policy or not. Even if they're not proven scientifically, as you just referred to, what should Ohioans be paying attention to if they're not experts in the business about what matters and what's showing results in a positive way?
Well, the results are shaping up pretty clear right now. We've had about 2 years fairly regular drilling into the resource shale play called the Utica here in the state of Ohio. What is shaping up is a sweet spot that begins up in Carroll County, a little bit in Columbiana, and extends about two townships wide, and extends down into Harrison, Guernsey on the eastern side, Noble, and Belmont counties, with high hopes now that it could go down this narrow fairway down into Washington County. We in the industry call it a sweet spot. And within that sweet spot, very narrow band, you have excellent geology, overpressurized formation, and large accumulations of oil and gas. Primarily, this is a natural gas play. It is not an oil play. It is a natural gas play with hopes of having high, we call it high BTU gas, high heat quantity gas, which means besides methane, there's other constituents in the natural gas that add to the heating value of this gas. And hopefully you can extract those products out, things like propane or ethane, longer chain molecules that you can either use for home heating purposes. Ethane, the chemical industry uses that and breaks it down in ethylene and then make plastics out of it.
And one of the ideas is that you require processing plants to do that, and they need to be nearby?
Well, processing is needed for two reasons. One, it's needed because these wells are so large in the sweet spot, in order to flow the natural gas into the interstate pipeline system, which is the only kind of system that could take this volume of production, you must meet certain federal standards set by tariffs at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And one of those is that you can only put in certain quality BTU. It has to be down around 1,035 on average. And they don't want a lot of liquids or water. So you must process to meet federal standards to enter the pipeline system. So it's actually a cost,
right?
Not a benefit.
It's a benefit to the people who are working in the processing plants.
Well, that's true. And I just had a group of legislators out last week at Mark West's new facility in Cadiz over in eastern Ohio, part of the Ohio Chamber's biannual legislative conference. And they were just amazed at the investment out there.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about fracking in Ohio. Promises made, promises kept. Depends on where you sit. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Trent Doherty, I want to get to you real quick. But first, I wanted to know, how many wells have been drilled?
In the area of about 200 to 300.
And is that what you were expecting by this point? I think in the thousands.
Yeah, that was hyperbole.
Once again.
That was hyperbole. Okay. People yapping 2 years ago on what it could look like. Maybe looking at the Pennsylvania experience or the North Dakota experience. They've drilled 6,000 wells into the Marcellus of Pennsylvania. That's a six-year history. Ohio's experience is in its infancy. Nobody can make a promise on an oil and gas well unless you drill a hole in the ground and find out what's down there.
Which is part of the problem, right, Trent? First, you have to drill. I have to go back to what Tom Stewart just said. You don't know what will happen until you drill the hole, and that's part of the problem of regulating it?
Exactly. And it's the economics, the actual drilling, it all seems to be in Ohio a moving target. The job numbers from coming out as it's going to be 200,000 jobs to, I think Ohio State came back and said, no, it's more like 20,000. You're going to have this, we've seen maps of where a couple years ago where the shale play would be, and it covered a huge swath of Ohio, probably half of Ohio, getting closer to even us here in Franklin County. Now it's this, you know, this sweet spot. It's a moving target, but I think you really can and we should look to those experiences in Pennsylvania. And you'll hear in about an hour or so from Josh Probanek, who directed a movie, Triple Divide, about those experiences in Pennsylvania, where I think there's like 7,000 wells drilled. Currently, last time I checked with DNR, with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, they've had about 400 to 500 drilled in Ohio. And those folks that were yapping were the people from the administration saying that there'd be 2,500 wells drilled. And that's what we were trying to get in front of. Looking to what has happened in eastern Ohio for a century with coal, the hope was to get out in front of any problems that may occur, problems we saw in Pennsylvania and other states. That's why 2 years ago, Ohio Environmental Council and a bunch of other organizations went to the General Assembly, went to the Department of Natural Resources, March of 2011, 2 years before the first horizontal well, 2 months before the first horizontal well was drilled, and said, hey, let's make sure we get our regulations put in place. We see gaps. We see what Ohio has coming, whether it's these thousands and thousands of wells in the next couple of years, or even something shorter, that we need to make sure we're out in front of it. And to the governor's credit, we've gotten a little bit closer, but there's still some large gaps.
In fact, today is the one-year anniversary of the law changes that the Kasich administration ushered through the Ohio General Assembly. With lots of input from different parties last year, a series of reforms in the wake of a series of small earthquakes that rattled the Youngstown area in 2012. But that episode was associated with disposal of fracking contaminated water. And I want to talk about that, too. Tom Stewart, are you satisfied? I mean, are you comfortable with the laws that were passed a year ago? And are you disturbed at all that the rules still haven't been put in place for those laws?
Oh, and it's hard to comment upon the pace of government. I think probably both Trent and I would, from our various perspectives, would grind our teeth on how government moves forward.
The rule process is often overlooked, and it should be time-consuming.
Should be done by now. I agree with that. The incident that happened up in Mahoning County involved one well. The DNR, Department of Natural Resources, and the governor reacted appropriately at the time and shut down all operations, not only at that well, but anything within a five-mile circle. That well has not been put back into operation. I think they had the appropriate authority to do that. And nothing has occurred to allow that well to go back into operation. That is a case of a well that intersected a known slip fault block, is what it's called, and about 200 feet into the basement rock, and lubricated it with the injection of brine. There would have been an event with this slip fault block sometime anyways, but it made it happen sooner. So the potential for seismicity, not authentic earthquakes, but seismicity was always there. They reacted appropriately and said, shut that operation down, and I applaud them for doing that.
A lot of people are frustrated that Ohio is sort of a dumping ground for fracking waste. Is that a concern of the Ohio Environmental Council? We're talking about fracking, but the waste issue is the other side of the equation.
Yeah, for a number of reasons, Ohio has been the low-rent, high-risk dumping ground
for industrial waste in general.
Things.
Right,
a lot
not
of
just
things.
This.
You know, goes back to construction and demolition debris from
right.
New Jersey and New York to an influx of oil and gas waste, drilling waste, and brines from Pennsylvania. And you know, we're still open for business when if New York decides to bring theirs over and other states. And yes, it's a concern because of things like drilling into known fault lines that something is going to occur.
It wasn't a known fault line.
I thought you said it was known.
It was not known at the time. It was
okay.
not known at the time
think,
that they intersected
just,
a fault
Tom,
line.
Tom, I think you did say that, but I corrected. It's not,
it was
not known at the time. It is
afterwards.
Now established.
And I think
right.
a part of that is also not just where it was, but the pressure and the amount that's being put in was unprecedented, and maybe there needed to be put some regulations in place. And I think the state has moved forward with those injection wells. There are still problems out there. There are still potential issues. Tom, you do bring up it. Yes, a lot of these issues are single issues, but there seems to be a lot of them that pop up from the Bainbridge incident in 2007, where an explosion occurred. Everything was supposed to be, the regulations were great back then, but the explosion did occur. We're supposed
well,
to have
let's
good,
clarify.
But they
let's
did address cl- the.
Let's clarify that. We had the Bainbridge incident. And then we did Senate Bill 165, in which we collaborated with your organization
Correct.
to put together was probably one of the more monumental oil and gas amendments to oil and gas law in the state of Ohio since that time in 2010. And I remember you wrote a letter supporting Senate Bill 165, which I gladly have in my file, Trent.
And you're on record.
So let's talk about the Bainbridge incident. There was an incident where one operator did not have a proper cement job. It was a well construction issue. It had zero to do with hydraulic fracturing.
Mm-hmm.
The DNR reacted appropriately, did their investigations, established what the cause was, came to the General Assembly, came to my association, came to Trent's organization, and we put together appropriate safeguards in law on well construction and hydraulic fracturing disclosure that has become one of the more advanced oil and gas laws since that time. So the public policy process works. So we have one incident of Bainbridge, and we have one UIC Class 2 well that has caused an issue, and people reacted appropriately. But it has been the law, Ann, since 1985 in the state of Ohio, that all water produced from an oil and gas well must be disposed of down a Class 2 well pursuant to and exceeding the standards of the federal landmark law known as Safe Drinking Water Act. And the state of Ohio, which has delegation from USEPA on that issue, has audited this program, and they're getting ready to do an audit again, which I welcome, that shows that the state of Ohio has appropriately managed this waste stream. We put it back in the same formation it came from or deeper.
But the key point, though, is that legislation has occurred, but it's occurred in a reactionary fashion, that it's because of Bainbridge that we had 165. We did support 165. We support what was in 165 still today. I stand behind that letter. It was the injection well issue in Youngstown that really got Senate Bill 315 running. And for the first time, Senate Bill 315 pointed out not just the injection well issue, but that horizontal wells should be treated differently. You actually have horizontal wells singled out for a lot of the safety measures that need to be put in place with these rules that we haven't seen in a year.
Right.
And but still, the things that we had pointed out and we point out throughout this process in the 2 years and even some things we brought up in 2010 in Senate Bill 165 still haven't been covered yet. And we're, I think, tired of waiting for the next thing to happen.
The next thing to happen is we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Trent Doherty of the Ohio Environmental Council and Tom Stewart of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association about the fracking business in Ohio. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the fracking business in the state of Ohio. It's been a couple years. We've been talking about House Bill 315, which still hasn't had its rules written. And anybody who follows the legislative process knows that getting the law enacted is one thing. Getting the rules written is a completely different thing. It's been a year now. Today is the one-year anniversary. Still no rules. And I wanted to get back to that briefly. Tom Stewart, you're frustrated, too. What's not getting done? Does it matter to the business? What's not getting done with because these rules have not been established?
If the rule package was complete, then there'd be a lot more regulatory clarity out there. And so obviously the industry is expecting it, and I'm sure that that the environmental community is expecting that as well. In the defense of the Department of Natural Resources and Oil and Gas Regulatory Program, they have an awful lot going on right now, and they've had to ramp up their knowledge base because they're dealing with a class of oil and gas exploration and development that has not occurred in the state of Ohio before at this kind of size and critical mass. It's a completely different industry. And meanwhile, they have to worry about the conventional industry as well.
Governor Kasich was very, very enthusiastic about this a couple years ago, and you have given him credit for beefing up some of the inspection, the number of inspectors and that sort of thing. But have they come through for you when it comes to this bill? And you make a good point, Tom. Have they beefed up ODNR and Ohio EPA to deal with this new exploration and the work that goes with it?
Yes, and there's definitely more staffing at Department of Natural Resources. The question is, what exactly are they doing? Tom is right that they're faced with something that they haven't been faced with. And that, again, goes to our point. Let's get your ducks in a row before you start moving forward on this. From some of the folks that are members of our organization, they see this. They see, DNR hasn't put their rules. There's no clarity for the communities. There's clarity for the industry. Seems like DNR is just there stamping permits that come through. Some 800 permits and 500 wells drilled. And we're still working on a law that was passed without any clarity in terms of the regulations. And that's we think, disturbing, especially when you look at also, we think there are still some gaps that need to be filled in the law that would then necessitate them to do more rules. So
I want to get to that. This week, the Ohio Environmental Council put forth a proposed upgrade of the Ohio State's oil and gas laws. I want to get to that in just a second. We have an email question from Al. Does the industry think they will eventually drill on state land? And if so, when does ODNR think they will allow that to happen? Of course, we don't have ODNR on the show right now, but Tom Stewart, is this something that is seriously being pursued, or just...
It should be.
Okay.
When we talk about Ohioans' oil and gas, that is Ohioans' oil and gas. We've heard the governor say that we can't let these out-of-state companies come in and take our oil and gas, but the oil and gas he's talking about in that instance belongs to private landowners. It's their oil and gas. It's their property that's being developed right now, and not the state of Ohio's. They have the authority under law. They did that, I think it was House Bill 133, Trent, yep. Several years ago, that gave them the authority to do that, and they haven't done it. And frankly, I think somebody needs to tell the Ohio public why not.
But the Ohio public also owns what's above ground, too, and that's state land that's being preserved for posterity for other reasons.
Like Salt Fork Park, which is a reclaimed strip mine. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I do appreciate Tom and your benevolence here to make sure that the people of Ohio get their money's worth.
Just trying to help out.
You know, I think that, you know, when you talk about state lands, that's a lot of land. But what we're really, I think what the question focuses on are the 1% of the land in Ohio that was set aside for parks, for nature preserves, for those lands that were supposed to be off, not to be open for industrial activity. There's 99% of the vast Ohio countryside that's open for drilling today. Even before 133, there was state lands, corrections facilities, other plots owned by the state that could be open for drilling. Really, the focus was on the state parks, like Salt Fork, like those other state parks that are all across eastern Ohio. And you know, I'm fine with it not being touched, and I think the people of Ohio are fine with it not being touched. You know, in these economic times, people are taking these stay vacations, staying in Ohio, and going to these state parks. And the key is to make sure that it's a place to get away from the industrial activity that they see. And there's no, in our point of view, there's no reason to disturb that, especially with the advent of horizontal drilling. You can be a mile away and drill, and we haven't even discussed there are opportunities to drill where you don't have to be on the parkland where
that's absolutely true. For example, up the Berlin Reservoir up in Portage County, which is federal lease, federal lands, federal minerals, but with state property reservoirs over recreational areas, the entire portion of Berlin Reservoir has been fully exploited in the Clinton Sandstone Reservoir. And nobody knows where those wells are at unless you take them and drive in and you see them. Because all of the Berlin Reservoir was accessed by directional drilling off-site and not out in the water. So you can do this activity and not disturb people's views about why this land's being used.
But the governor, made the distinction that it's the people who own the property above own the natural resource below.
Here's what else they own.
If you drilled for it off-site, would the state reap the benefits?
Oh, yeah, because you'd have to have a state lease on the minerals underground that from which you are extracting the oil and gas. The other thing that Ohioans may not realize is that they have over $500 million deficit on problems that the state of Ohio cannot maintain and keep up on these state parks. So they're falling down around themselves, even as there could be a resource there to help them repair this kind of stuff.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Trent Doherty of the Ohio Environmental Council and also Tom Stewart of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Email question from Marianne. Tom Stewart notes that the ODNR reacted after the earthquakes and there was legislation after an explosion. I don't mean to yap, but wouldn't it be better to have regulations prior to such events? For example, shouldn't Ohio have an appeals process whereby property owners and residents can appeal state drilling permits? And I know that, Trent Doherty, proposed legislation. This week, the Ohio Environmental Council put forward the proposed upgrade of Ohio state oil and gas laws. And that is one of the things that you're pushing for.
Absolutely, it's something that I think is been missing, the ability for landowners and affected parties to be able to appeal these permits that get these 500 to 800 permits and more that we see coming down the line. And it's not to say no, we don't want this. It's really focused on that the permits are the permits right for that area that affect landowners, that affect other people downstream, downwind. And you know, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the quote-unquote safeguards for these wells are within these terms and conditions, these site-specific terms and conditions that are in these permits that aren't in law, that aren't in rules. They allude to them in the law and the rules, but it's really these terms and conditions. And the key is to make sure those terms and conditions are right. And that's what a good notice, permit notice to the public is needed, which is not there. A good comment period for people to tell Department of Natural Resources their concerns, their real concerns about what this particular operation is going to potentially do to their area, both good and bad, so that a proper permit can be done, and then have that. Then, if it's still not good, to have that ability to appeal that permit. It's not going to slow anything down. Every other industry has this. Every other industry has this.
I was going to ask Tom Stewart, is there a template for this, something like this, in other states that where it's working, where there is this kind of a permitting process?
Here's the reality about oil and gas permitting. The oil and gas drilling permit, which is the permit you need, issued from the Department of Natural Resources in order to drill a well on a properly spaced drilling unit in the state of Ohio, is issued based upon the fact that you as the producer, the person requesting the permit, have met all the requirements of Ohio law and Ohio Administrative Code. Have you met these requirements with this proposal that you have brought to us to drill this well? As it relates to spacing, as it relates to well construction, your plans for completing and producing the well, your plans for interacting with society around you, have you done all of these things that have all been made part of law and regulatory code? It's not an issue of whether somebody down the road doesn't want to see an oil and gas well drilled on their neighbor's property.
But let's take another example, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. They have a process whereby utilities request changes in rates and that sort of a thing to cover expenses they have. And there's also, an opportunity for the public to appeal or to weigh in. They may be saying everything's exactly right, but...
But, Ann, you're confusing a company that has a guaranteed rate of return called a utility with an oil and gas producer who is at the complete control of the marketplace. So we're not asking... for us, anybody to guarantee us a rate of return, or that we're going to get our money back, or that, or whatever. However,
the process of appeal that people can, the public can step in and appeal the decision of the state.
The template is not the Public Utilities Commission. That is a good one to bring. The template is with there are actually two. One, again, I've mentioned coal earlier. The coal regulatory program in the state of Ohio. If you had 100 acres of land set aside for coal mining in a particular area, you would have 4 weeks of notice that a permit was coming. You would have at least a 30-day comment period. You'd have the ability to have a conference with the Department of Natural Resources on that permit, and then you would have, if you still felt that you were going to be adversely affected as a landowner, as an affected party, you could appeal it to the Reclamation Commission. That same 100 acres, if it's in that same spot, if it's for oil and gas, you don't have any of that.
Tom Stewart, if there were regulations like that in Ohio, would the oil and gas and would it still be in business,
let's be brutally honest about this. An oil gas well takes up very small amounts of space when it's finally completed. Even large shale development takes up a relatively small amount of space once it is completed. To compare it to the coal industry, in the most prevalent way of mining coal in the state of Ohio is with longwall mining, in which you have subsidence that actually drops people's lands, 15, 20, 25 feet?
It changes the topography.
It changes topography. It changes freshwater resources. It could destroy your home. It could change everything. Of course the public should have some input on that. If they're going to come underneath my land and mine, and my house might drop 20 feet. That's not the same case with oil and gas.
Well, let's go to the next analogy really quick. Absolutely any other industrial activity that has to be permitted by Ohio EPA for an air permit, a water permit, whether it's putting up a residential area, a residential development, a commercial building, they need to get permits from Ohio EPA. And there's that same process of notification, multiple forms of notification, 30-day comment periods, back and forth with the with the public, with the permittee, with the state. And again, those permits can be appealed to the Environmental Review Appeals Commission. That's the commission that hears those from Ohio EPA. And speaking of that commission, a vast majority of those permits are appealed by the permittee who does not like what's in their permit.
So it would cut both
so
ways.
Not, yeah, so and not even you know, your members don't even have the ability to appeal those terms and conditions that are not in law, that
yeah,
are not
can.
In rule.
Yeah, they can. You can take that to the Oil and Gas Commission. You can.
They can take it, but we can't.
Yeah. Let's be brutally honest about this.
This is
an effort to stop development. If you're an oil and gas producer, every day you're drilling a new well to replace reserves. It's the lifeblood of the industry. And it's not like setting up a factory that needs air permits and all these other analysis to meet federal requirements, mainly flowing from the federal government. It's not like doing that. But this is an effort to try to overlay a cumbersome bureaucratic system on and to slow it down. And to slow down people's opportunities.
We have an email from Michael asks, Trent, is OEC still pushing for a moratorium? And Tom, if we had a moratorium, what would that mean? So yes or no, you still pushing for one?
Well, our moratorium from back in 2011, it was set up as, hey, we are in front of what's going to happen. I think we may have had two permits, but nothing drilled, saying, hey, let's put the brakes on. Let's get these regulations
right.
in place. That's fallen on deaf ears. Oh. Although there have been a few changes, it's fallen on deaf ears. So we think, yeah, we need to do a slowdown, and perhaps the industry itself is slowing itself down. But we need to make sure we get these holes filled when it comes to regulation so we don't end up like any other state.
But you're
or any
saying
other
just even regulatory slowdown could hurt the industry substantially, a moratorium.
Every day, my members are drilling a new well, trying to replace the reserves that they produced and hopefully grow their company beyond that. It is the nature of the business. If you want a moratorium, then what you also want then is higher natural gas prices. Because the marketplace is called by the last molecule that enters the pipeline system and what that's priced at. And once you start cutting that off and depletion kicks in, you're going to see escalating energy costs.
If the regulations were to cost the industry more, and the industry would, rightly so, we live in a capitalist society, pass on the cost
you cannot
to the consumer.
But that's what's wrong in the thinking of the people. They think that an oil and gas producer can pass on their cost. An oil and gas producer gets paid what the price of oil and gas is posted on the New York Mercantile Exchange literally on a daily basis. We are price takers, not price makers. We get what traders of natural gas or traders of crude oil and New York Mercantile Exchange say a barrel of oil is worth or an MCF or a decatherm of gas is worth. And we can't call them up and say, oh, by the way, the Ohio administration raised our costs with regulation. Can you add 10 bucks to the price of crude? Now, they'll laugh you off the stock exchange floor. We don't call the price. The marketplace calls the price. We get what they give us. It's the same thing for a farmer. Farmer gets what they say in the Chicago Board of Trade, a bushel of corn is worth. Period.
We have time for just one more question, and I wanted to talk about the proposed regulations. First of all, actually two questions. You don't have a sponsor for this right now in the General Assembly?
No, we have. We've actually done something that's a little unusual, at least for
yeah.
us. Is instead of going behind the scenes looking for folks to push a certain thing, is that we're going to be. And we have been absolutely transparent. There's 34 or 37. I am not quite sure where it is right now. We lay it out. We've talked to a few lawmakers on a few of these points. And it's just to say, here we are. We're even asking for folks in the public, in the industry. Tell us where things need to be changed. And we're going to put this in here. It's like one mega bill. However, there are really four separate areas that we think could be pieced out to different pieces of legislation.
Okay.
But we'll be working on sponsorships very, very soon, actually.
But with the rulemaking still not complete on the last big regulatory bill for this industry, are you putting the cart before the horse? I mean, shouldn't...
My point of view is that DNR can be working on these rules right now while the legislature puts together theirs. They are far behind, and I don't want to put them on the spot, but you know this show is aptly named All Sides, and we've heard a lot throughout the past 2 years from Tom and a lot from OEC and other organizations on these two sides of the issue, but we don't hear where the state is. We don't hear where DNR is, and I want to know. But I think that they can work on those rules while we fill up the others. That way we don't have this huge time backlog that the industry is concerned about, and their profits go from $100 billion to $99 billion. I understand that. So let's start working now.
$100 billion, that's an awful lot of money.
I don't know. Wow. It's a moving target when your numbers that come out.
I have lots of emails and lots of questions from people that I'm not going to get to today, and I apologize to everybody. I will not get to the calls as well. I do want to say thanks to both of you for joining us again. I know time flies when you're having fun.
It's always fun with Tom.
Tom Stewart, he's the Executive Vice President of Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Tom, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
It's fun to be here.
Really appreciate it. And Trent Doherty, Director of Legal Affairs for the Ohio Environmental Council. Glad you could finally make it on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Coming up, we're going to hear from a couple of documentary filmmakers about what's up in Pennsylvania with fracking. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A new documentary film highly critical of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and its oversight and regulation of shale gas development there is making the rounds. It will be screened tonight in Columbus. For more information, check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. I said the film is highly critical of the Pennsylvania agency charged with oversight and regulation of the shale gas development there. For that reason, we invited a representative of that state agency to join us on the show today. An agency spokesperson declined the invitation. The film is titled The Triple Divide, and joining us now are its two co-directors, Melissa Troutman. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thanks, Ann.
And also Joshua Prabanik.
Prabanik. Yes.
Yeah. Welcome to the show, Joshua.
Thank you, Ann.
First, tell us about the title of the film, The Triple Divide, which is in reference to the area as a continental divide area. Mm-hmm. Why is that significant?
Well, Triple Divide is significant considering the vast range of its watersheds. It's one of the only, or it's one of four triple continental divides in North American continent. It's a place where one raindrop falls to three separate watersheds that are formed in that specific place. For Ohio, it would be the beginning of the Allegheny River, which of course flows into the Ohio River watershed and down into the Gulf. It's the beginning of the Genesee, which flows into the St. Lawrence River Basin, and the beginning of Pine Creek, which goes into the Chesapeake Bay. So it's a very vast watershed. So particular things that might happen there could affect a much larger range than in other places.
So this isn't just about Pennsylvanians then?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
In the film, you accuse the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection of corruption. They are not here to defend themselves by their own choice. But tell us what you mean by corruption. Are we talking about kickbacks, conflicts of interest? What do you mean by that? Melissa?
Well, there's a bit of a revolving door when it comes to the DEP and the industry, in that DEP, people who work within the DEP go to work for industry after they leave the DEP, or they come from industry to work there. Our former Secretary of DEP, Michael Kranzer,
That they Krancer talked heavily about the ability of the DEP to regulate the industry using the data that they had. One of the most important pieces of data that the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection uses is the pre-drill testing data. What we ended up finding during our investigations and looking closely at the worst case scenarios in Pennsylvania, or even just homeowner cases where they had water contamination issues, we were finding that the DEP was allowing the gas industry to dismiss their own baseline data, dismiss their own science that said a water well was clean, and then say that that particular well was contaminated, always had been contaminated by background conditions, and therefore declares a pre-existing condition. And when they do that, it changes the water quality history. So essentially, since DEP isn't willing to enforce the law, since they're not able to prosecute because of such limited resources, these particular things are things that we thought were scandals. They thought that we thought the DEP really should have upheld the law. They thought that we they should have held the industry accountable in these particular instances.
Big difference between Pennsylvania and Ohio. In Ohio, they've drilled 200, 300 wells, maybe upwards of 500 by the end of the year. In Pennsylvania, it's around 6,000 wells. Something like that.
It's over 6,000.
Over 6,000. And that's what you're talking about. Their resources are limited. That's a lot.
Absolutely. You know, when it comes to Ohio, you're really looking at a state in its infancy of shale gas development. They have not seen much of what Pennsylvania has seen. And in particular, Ohio laws, after looking more closely at them, are not nearly as stringent as some of the Pennsylvania laws, particularly, again, when we look at pre-drill testing. You know, the updated what they were considering kind of a momentous thing in Ohio, what Tom Stewart and Trent were talking about with Senate Bill 315, only requires pre-drill testing 1,500 feet away from a well. In Pennsylvania, it's 2,500 feet. So there's a lot of things that Ohioans could be learning from people in Pennsylvania. And even though they've been looking at Pennsylvania for the last few years, they haven't necessarily made those changes.
Yours is not the first cautionary tale written or filmed about fracking. The criticism has been constant for some years now, inspiring what has been hailed as a landmark federal study of the process at a Western Pennsylvania drilling site. The authors of that study claim that fracking shows no evidence that the chemicals used in the process have come close to contaminating drinking water aquifers in the area.
Yes, these kind of statements are pretty...
Now, this is a federal study.
Yes, yes. Okay. I think that what they're talking about is specifically the particular chemicals that are used in the fracking process. Mm-hmm. When we look at DEP's gas migration investigations, we do not see evidence of those particular chemicals being tested for when they're looking at these different confidential investigations. What they generally test for are things like methane, naturally occurring contaminants like arsenic, barium, strontium, sodium, manganese, and those particular things. And we do see very many cases across Pennsylvania where water supplies have been contaminated by these naturally occurring contaminants that are released by the fracking process.
Right. We have an email from Frank. He wrote, "Ann, I used to live in Washington, Pennsylvania. However, I moved away in 1968. I still have family living in there who, even though they live in the city, must buy water for drinking and cooking. Mm-hmm. Also, many farmers now have water trucked in for human and cattle use. I have seen the trucks myself. Much of the water is poison and not usable."
Yes, for different locations, depending upon where you're at, I would cite the Sugar Run gas migration investigation in Bradford County, Pennsylvania, where 18 families were affected, and they had explosive levels of methane in the drinking water, which is over 28 milligrams per liter. Those particular homes, you know, they had to be cautious about their water. They certainly didn't want their farm animals drinking that water. And in some cases, farmers had no choice. They didn't have an extra water supply because they weren't willing to sign on to the oil and gas company's agreement because they didn't want to be gagged. So they were forced, you know, to distribute the water that they had to either their kids, their families, or their animals. And it's something that the state, I think, should step in and take care of when that kind of thing happens. I don't think it should be left up to the industry to supply them with water. In that case, the state should really come to their need.
On the issue of land rights, we're going to listen to a cut from the film now. The Pennsylvania landowner David Barnt claims his land was used for a fracking operation without his consent.
I've basically paid the tax, and my grandfather's paid the tax for 60 years to be a visitor, just so Triana could come in and do this. you know, you contact the Department of DEP or any other people, and you're on your own.
Okay, your film is critical of the DEP, as I said before, the Department of Environmental Protection, both for its dealings with the complaints of landowners and its regulation of the industry. Aren't they just following the laws set up in the state of Pennsylvania? Is the state of is the DEP doing anything illegal at this point, per se?
Well, that's a good point. The DEP doesn't have any very much authority over the split estate issue. That's something our legislators should be addressing. And, you know, David Barnt is one of the many people that are in the film. You know, these are cases that the media hasn't covered yet. We cover a lot of new cases. You need to see a lot of new faces in the film. But yeah, the split estate issue is a major issue. David's case is particularly troublesome. He has spent thousands and thousands of dollars on lawyers to try to, you know, find some sort of justice, and he's unsuccessfully, because the law is written in such a way that it favors the mineral rights lease.
Yeah, and in correlation to Ohio, we have the unitization law here, which is very similar to the split estate, so that if your neighbors lease their land and you don't lease yours, you could be forced to deal with natural gas development. You could be forced to have a well pad.
All the negative.
You could be forced to feel the effects of natural gas, even though you haven't particularly signed a lease. So in that respect, your case in Ohio would align very similar to David Barnt's case. And the oil and gas laws at this point are not very friendly to those particular cases. And it's just, there's a requirement in Pennsylvania that just says that they ask the drilling companies to attempt to come to an agreement. But that doesn't mean that it's required.
And I'm not surprised, because I'm trying to figure out what would resolve the issue of the split estate. It's like the lady or the, I mean, what would resolve it?
David Barnt and his father, you know, are in no way anti-drilling or anti-gas, and they were willing to negotiate with the company and talk with the company, but they, in their words, were just walked all over, because they aren't, it's their property, but they don't live there. They actually live 4 hours away, so.
I want to grab another cut from the film before we run out of time on the issue of agricultural contamination. Dr. Andrew Keene of Bowling Green State University in Ohio.
Dr. Keir.
Dr. Keir.
I'm sorry, Keir. Let's listen to what he has to say.
Sixth generation ranchers in New Mexico couldn't ranch anymore because, you know, the land was so taken up by natural gas development. So I have a feeling that this might be an issue in Ohio and Pennsylvania as the boom moves along, specifically with agriculture and kind of the impact on agricultural lands and natural gas development.
Okay, so is in Ohio, it's one thing. In Pennsylvania, is agriculture and ranching a big issue there?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, Pennsylvania, just like Ohio, agriculture is one of their number one industries in the state. And in Ohio, I think, you know, you listened to Tom Stewart earlier talk about how the large the acreages of these wells and how minimal that was. But that's simply not true, because what comes off of the well is also a very serious thing. The wells themselves can be up to, you know, 15 acres in some cases, plus you have all the road development.
But is there something coming up through the, I mean,
well,
it's
the
not
farmers
just
that,
at the drilling operation?
The farmers that we've talked to who finally opened up to us after 2 years, they watched the film, they respected the film, they wanted to talk to us more, were telling us that they began having problems with yields in soy, yields in corn, particularly because of where the well pads were placed and the runoff of the well, what was running off of the well. And they had what was very obvious degradation of their fields. And then they also had problems with pipeline companies, yield loss with pipeline companies that they didn't originally think about putting in their lease, putting provisions in their lease to deal with. So they had to go through the courts. They had to come to an agreement with the industry in order to be compensated for their losses in yields in corn, soy, other crops, as pipelines were put in, as wells were put in, and then there was an effect off that well.
And farmers who raised livestock have reported health issues with their stock, too.
Okay. Well, that's where we have to leave it at this point. Melissa Troutman and Joshua Probanek. Probanek. Sorry, I didn't get a pronouncer on that. And our co-directors of the film, The Triple Divide. You can learn more about it. It's screening tonight in Columbus. Go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link with more information for you. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having
me. Good to be here. Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.